I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. I'm Dorothy Holmes, and I am your worship associate today. Our very own and most valued minister, Reverend Lisa Day, is our worship leader. Becca Flaherty, a much appreciated member of UUCS, is our guest pianist. Our worship, religious education, and covenant group theme for October is cultivating compassion. Compassion is a greatly needed quality in these demanding and unsettling times. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be, and wherever you are on your journey. If you're visiting with us this morning, for the first time or for the first time in a long while, hint, hint, would you like to introduce yourself? Please rise or raise your hand. Chris will bring a microphone. As part of our commitment to accessibility, we use microphones whenever anyone speaks so that everyone in the sanctuary and watching on YouTube can hear. Are there any people on this side of the sanctuary who would like to introduce yourselves? Going one, two, three, okay. And on this side, are there any visitors who would like to introduce yourselves?
Hi, everyone. If this is how you welcome all newcomers, you are good to go, man. We're feeling very welcome. I'm Kelly Blackmar, and this is my husband, Jeff Applewhite. And I was, Judy says that I have to say this. I was the music director here for almost 30 years and left in 2021 to go be with my love. And we now live in southwestern Virginia in the mountains where we bought some property and we're building a farmhouse. So living the dream, as it were. But really miss all you so much, and so glad to come and be here with you today.
Anyone else? We will greet you just as warmly. Yes. Yes.
Wow. Greg Giles and Teresa West, we are down here for the week from St. Paul, Minnesota, so glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Wow. In joys and sorrows, I'll offer my psychoanalytic explanation for all of this enthusiasm. If you are looking for a new faith community, we encourage you to visit several times to get a feel for our worship style and our approach to matters of faith and religion. It's good to have you all with us, Please join us in Ron Hall for refreshments following the service. You'll find Ron Hall in the next building by following the crowd through this door or the main doors, or ask the ushers. After the story for all ages and after the offering, we sing a short response. The lyrics are printed in your order of service. There are two cards in the pew back in front of you to help you gather information for the good of our community. Use the QR code on the Rainbow Chalice card to sign up for our newsletter and to receive a welcoming letter from our minister. Or, if you prefer, fill the card out by hand. The card with the red heart and chalice is there to share a joy or sorrow. If you fill out either of these cards, please put it in the collection plate as it comes around. Church announcements are emailed to members and friends on Tuesdays and Fridays. Check your email for complete details about all announcements for this week. I will offer a couple of announcements in addition. This is from RE. The kids in RE invite you to visit the Tree of Compassion. How say you, kids? Do you do that?
Yes?
Yes, okay. Take an ornament or temporary tattoo or contribute to our project by writing or drawing, "What does compassion mean to you?" I also want to note that our search for a music director is active and fervent. Please spread the word and the job description. There is a link to the job description in the email announcements. We also are in need of additional ushers. I think we all appreciate how the ushers make our services orderly and welcoming, and we need more of them. So if you are interested, please know that Susan Daggett is our new coordinator, and her contact information is available in our family directory and will be sent out in future emails so that you can handily contact her. With the lighting of our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into sacred time. Our chalice lighter this morning is Jim Cook. The chalice lighting reflections today are from two sources. The first from Brian Stevenson, the author of Just Mercy, and second from Rosalina Chai. From Stevenson, each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. And from Chai, when I accept my own brokenness and do not judge myself harshly because of it, I find myself capable of more compassion towards others, regardless of whether I am aware of the form of brokenness they have experienced.
Come into this moment as if stepping into a garden at dawn, quiet, tender, open to what may grow. Let compassion be the flower we bend toward. We return as if returning to the soil, hands in the dirt, willing to tend what needs tending. Here, today, we gather to remember that the most delicate blooms require daily care, that attention is the water of love, that we are still learning how to care. Come, let us begin again in love, tending the garden of the heart and the heart of compassion. Let us worship together.
Love at the center. This church, in its wisdom and strength, has started a worship practice to respond with love at this time in our country when love is constantly threatened by pernicious prosecutions, stop-and-frisk-like vigilantism, and many other destructive actions practiced by our nation's administration. We call our new worship practice Love at the Center. To put love at the center today, I offer the following guidance on how to love, slightly adapted from Thich Nhat Hanh's How to Love principles in his Mindfulness Essentials as follows. And Reverend Lisa and I did not coordinate this, but it's interesting that we're both calling on Buddhism, the Buddhist tradition. When you love someone, you must have trust and confidence. Love without trust is not yet love. Of course, first you must have trust, respect, and confidence in yourself. Trust that you have a good and compassionate nature. You are part of the universe. You are made of stars. When you look at your loved one, you see that they also are made of stars and carry eternity inside. Looking in this way, we naturally feel reverence. True love cannot be without trust and respect for oneself and for the other person. We enter a time to share our joys and sorrows with each other. We have several joys and two sorrows or concerns. I'll start with the sorrows. Dawn Ratz, a friend of our church, sent us a sorrow. She asked for our healing prayers for her friend Jen, whose mother had surgery for skin cancer, and whose loved horse, Marilyn, is struggling to recover from some health issues. And from Vicki, we're asked to please keep Judy Saucerman in thought. She had hip surgery. And now to the joys. And it was really struck and moved in our earlier enthusiasm during the visitors' ceremony. And it was so enthusiastic, and I know it was in large measure because a dear friend of ours came back to see us. But I think it's beyond that, and I will say personally, I have felt so much joy in the last 24 hours due to the No Kings events yesterday. In which millions of people showed up, and it's such an example of small things we can do that will have big impact. And in that same vein, now numerous universities are stepping up and saying no to these horrible compacts. So now it's University of South Carolina, Princeton, MIT, the University of Virginia, and did someone say?
Brown,
yes. And the University of Pennsylvania. Is that what's right? Did somebody say that? Yeah, okay. And, of course, the Big Ten Conference, which did this even before the elite schools. So, now, more joys. This is from Vicki Weeks. I'm simply overjoyed at the massive turnout, both in Savannah and nationally and internationally, for the pro-democratic rallies. Savannah had twice as many people as the last No Kings event. Great for Savannah, yes. And this is from Gail Moberg. Thank you to Ernie and Lynn Hollingsworth for joyfully sharpening my knives this week. Sorrowfully, I already cut my finger, but it's healing nicely. A donation was made in Ernie and Linda's name in today's offering. Very nice. And another lifting up of the No Kings rally. no name, anonymously. Wow. Okay. So, let us hold all our joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken, in our hearts as we join together in the responsive reading found in your order of service. Sorrow is everywhere.
Yet joy is everywhere.
As we mourn together,
so we celebrate together,
and offer thanks,
that we are not alone.
So may it be, now and in all the days to come. Amen.
We continue in a spirit of meditation. The words of meditation this morning come from Nadia Bolz-Weber. Ms. Bolz-Weber is an ordained Evangelical Lutheran Church of America minister and a New York Times best-selling author. A prayer for those who are losing our expletive deleted right now. Ms. Weber herself doesn't delete anything, but... Dear God, please forgive me for how I acted when that Amazon truck was blocking my driveway the other day. In your endless compassion, you know my rage was really about every form of fear I am trying to keep at bay right now. How it all sort of broke through my exhausted defenses because I was coming home from the gym and was really hungry. When I see others not being the best versions of themselves, guide me to compassion for them, that in doing so, I might also have compassion for myself. You know how fragile we are. And next time, when I am that hungry, please nudge me to eat a darn sandwich first, and then respond to whatever it is that feels like it's trying to attack me. And when, oh God, I inevitably try and control everything and everyone in my life, please have mercy upon me. For you know that what I am really doing is responding to how powerless I feel over every single thing in the news cycle every single day. Accept, O Lord, my shabby little prayer, for those are the only ones I have in me right now. Amen. Our first reading this morning comes from Ram Dass, who was a psychology professor at Harvard, who collaborated with Timothy Leary into research and experiments in psychedelics, and then traveled to India, where he met a Hindu guru and became a spiritual leader, teacher, and writer. Now, this piece depends on an understanding of Caspar Weinberger, and I know that many of you are too young to have known that Caspar Weinberger was the Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan for most of the 1980s. So if that's not a person who has meaning for you, you can replace that name with someone who seems to encapsulate your frustrations with the current administration, or Congress, or other sources of power. From Ram Dass. There was a time when my aggravation with the system focused on Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense. I'm sure he was no worse than many others, but there was something about his cold arrogance and apparent lack of wisdom that infuriated me. So I got a picture of Caspar, and I placed it on my prayer table with all my spiritual heroes. Then each morning when I lit my incense and honored the beings represented on the prayer table, I'd feel waves of love and appreciation toward my guru, Buddha, Christ, Anandamaya, Ramana, Maharshi, and Hanuman. I'd wish them each good morning with such tenderness. Then I'd come to Casper's picture, and I'd feel my heart constrict, and I'd hear the coldness in my voice as I said, "Good morning, Casper." Each morning, I'd see what a long way I still had to go. But wasn't Casper just another face of God? Couldn't I oppose his actions and still keep my heart open to him? Wouldn't it be harder for him to become free of the role he was obviously trapped in if I, with my mind, just kept reinforcing the traps by identifying him with his acts? I could see my guru rushing about in the wardrobe room at Central Casting, putting on one mask after another, shouting at me, "Bet you can't find me behind this one. Bet this one really fooled you." Not the Casper mask, Maharishi. No. Oh, no. The Indian poet Kabir and Maharishi often repeated, "Do what you do to another person, but never put them out of your heart." It's a tall order. But what else is there to do? Sometimes there is really nothing to do. We can only work on ourselves to keep another person in our heart, to be there, open, waiting, loving, spacious, non-judging, appreciating, and listening. Our second reading from Stuart Kestenbaum, Holding the Light. Gather up whatever is glittering in the gutter, whatever has tumbled in the waves or fallen in flames out of the sky. For it's not only our hearts that are broken, but the heart of the world as well. Stitch it back together. Make a place where day speaks to the night and earth speaks to the sky. Whether we created God or God created us, it all comes down to this. In our imperfect world, we are meant to repair and stitch together what beauty there is. Stitch it with compassion and wire. See how everything we have made gathers the light inside itself and overflows. A blessing. And finally, from Naomi Shihab Nye, What Changes? My father's hopes travel with me years after he died. Someday we will learn how to live, all of us surviving without violence, never stop dreaming how to cure it. What changes? Crossing a small street in Doha Souk, nut shops shuttered. A handkerchief lies crumbled in the street, maroon and white, like the one my father had from Jordan. Perfectly placed in his pocket under his smile for years, he would have given it to anyone. How do we continue all these days? Here end our readings. Last week, I spoke at length about surviving in today's world without being swamped with compassion fatigue, about the two steps I believe will buoy us up even as our days and hours are filled with situations demanding our compassion, that will protect our hearts while allowing us to participate in the healing of the unending sorrow that surrounds us. Face the pain. Act to alleviate the pain. Act in small, perhaps unexpected ways that we might not even recognize as helpful. I mentioned some of the circumstances that call forth our compassion: victims and survivors of natural disasters, gun violence, unjust employment practices, and unlawful detention. People we know intimately or casually, and people whose stories we learn only through the news. So many people, so many urgent invitations to be compassionate. I spoke about all that. I didn't address a question that should be central to any discussion of compassion for us as a people of faith, as Unitarian Universalists, as a community that holds love at its center. Who deserves our compassion? Are there people or groups of people outside our capacity or our province for showing compassion? Like perpetrators of gun violence, perhaps, or public figures who spread hate speech, vitriol, dangerous disinformation, who have ruined lives, destroyed families and communities, caused deaths through any number of direct and indirect means. Are we called to include them among those for whom we have compassion when they are hurting? These are questions I admit I hadn't spent much time considering until this fall. Then a couple things happened to challenge the stinginess of my own compassion. When Charlie Kirk was shot and killed on September 10th, many of my people, friends, colleagues, took to social media and attempted to walk the narrow and precarious line between not celebrating or glorifying any violent death and still remaining true to and vocal about the damage they knew the man had through his organization and his public appearances on college and university campuses done to countless young people. I understood the impulse behind their posts, though I chose not to attempt the same difficult feat. And I certainly recognized that the hyperbolic response of Charlie Kirk's supporters to such statements, not just statements from my friends, colleagues, and acquaintances, but from hundreds and thousands of others, meant not that those who had posted such things were cruel, evil, threats to personal or national security, or any of the other things that were said about them by Kirk's supporters. The hyperbolic response meant only that social media, a powerful tool, isn't a venue where subtlety and fine lines are either recognized or particularly effective, especially in such fraught and perilous times. One of my colleagues, the Reverend Dr. Marlon Lavenhar, senior minister at All Souls Church in Tulsa, used social media to respond quite differently. On Instagram, he posted a love letter to my conservative friends and neighbors. Today is the funeral for Charlie Kirk. I know this is a very emotional and painful day and time for many of you. Our whole nation has been impacted by his killing. Whatever your connection to him, whether political, personal, or symbolic, grief is real. And I can only imagine how hard it must be to watch the online mockery that so often follows the death of a public figure. That kind of pain cuts deep. I just want you to know, I see that, and I'm holding space for your sorrow. I'm sending love to you and yours today. I'm praying for our country. I hope we can all pray for one another. Dr. Lavenhar's letter was a masterclass in heartfelt, publicly expressed compassion. I don't know what he might have said about Charlie Kirk's words and actions prior to his death or in the weeks since. But in a moment when people were hurting, he recognized both the universality and the particularity of grief. He felt the pain of his conservative friends and neighbors, and he took action to help, sending love and prayers to alleviate their pain. He neither betrayed a hint of defensiveness about expressing love and prayers, nor attempted to justify the love and prayers. He didn't undo the expression of love and prayer by saying, But still, those who sow hate will reap what they sow. He stopped with love and prayer for his friends and neighbors, for our country, for all of us. When someone a few days later killed two detainees and injured a third at an ICE facility in Dallas, a neighbor was interviewed by a reporter, as neighbors often are. Her remarks caught me off guard. She said of the shooter, "I never imagined someone who felt so disenfranchised lived so close to me." That's never what the neighbors say. We've heard countless neighbors of alleged mass shooters or perpetrators of other violence interviewed. The neighbors always say, "He," because it almost always is a he was a quiet person who kept to himself, or he was a little strange, or they just didn't notice him that much. Maybe sometimes they say that he was helpful or friendly. The neighbors may be curious or bewildered, but they almost never reveal empathy or insight, at least not in the sound bites that make it to broadcast. But that neighbor did. "I never imagined someone who felt so disenfranchised lived so close to me." Her comment actually revealed more about her than about the shooter, about her capacity to see pain in someone who had just inflicted terrible pain, her capacity to feel the pain of disenfranchisement and move beyond feeling empathy into compassion. Last week, when I was going on and on about our need to act in the face of pain in order to protect ourselves from being overwhelmed by it, Megan was upstairs putting it more simply to our children. She told them, "Empathy plus help equals compassion." The neighbor of that shooter helped through the rare, profound, and very simple act of speaking words of empathy aloud into a microphone to be broadcast across the nation. "I never imagined someone who felt so disenfranchised lived so close to me." It's hard to believe that statement could have helped the shooter. He was already dead by then, but I'm convinced it did help. Maybe it helped his loved ones, who heard among a flood of words those few words that weren't condemning or hateful. Maybe it helped someone else who feels disenfranchised, who heard that sometimes someone tries to see them, understand, even just a stranger on the radio, perhaps from way across the country. And maybe, I think definitely, it helped in an infinitesimal yet not insignificant way shift our society's divisive rhetoric and unyielding, inflamed, and divided loyalties toward understanding, reconciliation, and repair. Or maybe it only helped jolt me into a more thoughtful, deeper, and broader consideration of compassion. That, too, is not insignificant. Preachers need to guard against complacency and against our own divisive, unyielding, inflammatory rhetoric and call ourselves back to impassioned yet principled and nuanced understandings and appraisals of the human condition and current affairs when we stray from those things. So I am grateful to that neighbor and to my colleague in Tulsa for the challenge their compassion issued to me and to all of us. They called me back into my universalism, that strand of our double strand of theology, back to my core belief that no one is beyond the love of God, back to what we as Unitarian Universalists have long affirmed, that every person has inherent dignity and worth. We can and must recognize, acknowledge, and condemn horrific words and violent acts of hatred that have always stained human souls and fractured human communities and claimed human lives in all times and places, and seem today to be a gathering tide of destruction, the magnitude of which we say hasn't been seen in 70 years, but in fact has been seen countless times in other countries over and over during those 70 years. And I do recognize, acknowledge, and condemn those horrific acts, the grand ones and the small, intimate ones. But if I cannot also act passionately when those who speak such compassionately, when those who speak such words and take such action suffer personal or familial loss, where then is my faith? Now let me be clear. Feeling empathy for someone who has done atrocious things and is now in pain, suffering from loss or grief, Kasper Weinberger perhaps, or whoever you substituted for him when listening to this morning's reading, or someone closer at hand in our city and neighborhoods or this community. Feeling empathy for someone who is in pain, suffering, and acting to alleviate that pain does not mean we suddenly excuse all the things we have found objectionable in their past and current behavior. It only means that we have refused to put them beyond the pale, beyond the reach of God's love or our compassion. And, by the way, the act we take to alleviate the pain need not be grand nor direct. It could be, probably is, that the most profoundly helpful act we can take in such situations is to remind ourselves of the full humanity of the person who is suffering. The act of that act of recall helps restore our humanity, and I firmly believe also helps heal the world and the person who is suffering. I need to be very clear about a second point. The call to be compassionate toward all people, because of our belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people, because our universalism says no one is beyond the salvation of the Holy's love, does not mean we owe people who have hurt us or abused us or mistreated us access to our lives, our time, or even necessarily our forgiveness, though that might help us heal our own pain. It does mean that if we learn those people are in pain, we extend compassion toward them, that we act to alleviate their pain in some way. But that action does not have to be visiting them, picking up the phone, or sending them a card. It can be saying a prayer, lighting a candle, resisting the urge to say, they were terrible to me and they deserve this terrible thing that has happened to them. Such gestures are healing in ways beyond our comprehension. We can maintain our boundaries and remain in integrity with our universalism. I've used the word God here a few times this morning. It was in our meditation and in my sermon, and we sang it in our last hymn, and I know it lands uneasily on some of your hearts. When we sang, "The love of God is broader than the measures of our mind, and the heart of the eternal is most wonderfully kind." The version I sang, the one in the old blue hymnal when I was growing up, had even more God in it. The opening line was, "There's a wideness in God's mercy." The closing hymn we'll sing in just a few minutes ends with this line, the lyricist, the poet William Blake, "Then every one of every clime that prays in deep distress prays to the human form divine. Love, mercy, pity, peace. Love, mercy, pity, peace." We dwell within a paradox as Unitarian Universalists. Whether we believe in God or not, or find the word God helpful to label that mysterious force or higher power at loose in the universe, we do tend to believe, or at least hope, that there is a love greater than our human capacity to love, a love more expansive than our own. And we definitely believe that whoever or whatever God may or may not be, we're the ones who are boots on the ground here and now. We're the face, voice, and hands, the human form that must embody and enact the love some of us attribute to God. Love is greater than our capacity, and we're all we've got. Compassion is a pathway toward resolving the paradox, and life abounds in situations that allow us to be compassionate. Last week, I spoke quite a bit about up-close and personal acts of compassion between parents and children, colleagues, and myself. This morning, I've spoken a lot about compassion across distances and in public circumstances. Opportunities to put universalism into practice through acts of compassion aren't limited, however, to either challenging ourselves with the humanity of people who have unleashed great hatred and violence upon the world, or to responding to the pain and suffering of people very close to us. When I was in college, someone told me that they say a prayer every time they hear a siren, because they know that if they hear a siren, someone is in trouble. I've thought about that a lot over the years, and sometimes what I think is, but how do they know someone is in trouble? How do they know if it's an ambulance or a fire truck or a police car? Okay, so probably some of you can tell the difference, but I can't. I think my dog can, because she only howls at certain sirens and not others. So how did that person know for sure that someone is in trouble whenever they hear a siren? I've come to realize that it doesn't matter if it's a fire or a medical emergency or a robbery or an act of violence that calls for police presence, or even if someone has called the police because they witnessed someone being black or brown or unhoused or speaking a language other than English. A siren does mean someone is in trouble, the sick or injured person, the victim, the black or brown or unhoused or non-English-speaking person, the perpetrator, the maker of the phone call, and, as likely as not, the first responders. They're all in trouble when we hear a siren of one kind or another. What a generous act of faith and compassion to say a prayer without knowing any more than that, without pausing to parse the circumstances or consider fault or assign worthiness. How that person's heart must grow each time they say that prayer, and how our rent and wounded world must be repaired just a tiny bit each time they say that prayer. May we all find such a practice to turn our compassion loose into a world that so needs it. Amen. May you embrace your growing with compassion. May courage be yours as you answer your heart's calling. May beauty and wonder be yours even when the going gets rough. And may love always be at your center. May it be so. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.